Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. On today's show, we will be hearing Dave teach about integrity and facing fear in decision making. We also have a special in-studio guest interview with Andy Andrews, New York Times best-selling author of How Do You Kill 11 Million People, The Noticer, The Traveler, and about somewhere around 7,000 other incredible books. So we are really excited about that. My name is Chris Licurdo, and I'm your host for the Entree Leadership Podcast, and I am so glad that you are joining us for another installation of this. Last episode, we talked to Jen Lim. We talked to her about inspiration and what she does at Zappos and delivering happiness to lead a culture of inspiration and happiness. Fabulous interview. If you didn't hear that, make sure that you go back and get that. But this week, we're going to be talking about integrity and decision-making. We're going to be talking about decision-making, period. What do you need to do about that? How do you make it? What are the keys to it? Why? Some of you might be sitting out there going, man, I really don't even have an issue with that. Well, you might be surprised as you listen through this, because the truth is decision-making is a very difficult thing in leadership. How do you make the right decisions? How do you actually make decisions instead of just sitting on the sidelines? Dave's going to illustrate why you can't react in fear when making decisions. Because the truth is, some people react in fear and make horrible decisions. And some people using fear don't make any decisions at all. He'll also talk about how to use your guiding values and how those should shape your decisions. What do you believe? What do you believe? How does that affect how you make decisions? So here is Dave Ramsey on decision making.
Options and walking through the worst case scenarios can virtually eliminate fear. If you have lots of options and you say, what's the worst case scenario? And then you emotionally accept the worst case scenario as survival, then you can not be afraid. How fun is that? I do that on the radio all the time. Somebody will call up and go, this is so bad. I think I'm behind like one payment on my mortgage and I think I'm going to be foreclosed on. What am I going to do? Makes great radio. But I get that call all the time, don't I? Okay, let's just stop a minute. Let's just say you got foreclosed on and then you had to file bankruptcy. And so now you're living in a two-bedroom apartment and you're still married and you still have your health and you still have your kids and you still have your job, but you don't have a house and you don't have any credit and all your debt's gone. Let's just visit there for a minute. I don't want to visit there. It's okay. Go with me. Stay with me here. Let's go over there. Sit with me in that apartment for a minute. You're still married, you still got your health, you still got your kids, you still have your job, you still have your life, you don't have any credit, and you don't have that house anymore. Is there life after foreclosure and bankruptcy?
Yeah, I guess there is.
If you can accept that worst case scenario, then we can start to work on the fact you're one payment behind. But right now you're in such freaking drama mode that you're not making any decisions that make any sense. And you're getting ready to go down to the payday lender and catch up your house payment. Don't do that stuff. Breathe. If that's your worst case scenario and you can survive the worst case scenario, then what happens? And then they can start to have some logic, remove themselves from the drama, start to address the situation, and see what the other options are. So if you analyze your worst case scenario and you can survive it, that's fine. Several years ago, we had developed a relationship with Salem Radio. Salem Radio is a big Christian operation, and they also have some mainstream talkers. We're primarily on, the vast majority of our stations are mainstreamers, meaning that we're not on Christian radio very much, mainly because Christian radio is nonprofit, and so they don't have any commercial breaks. So our broadcast is not something they can carry. But we're on a few of the commercial Christians around, but we're mainly on mainstream, main, regular talk radio shows. Stations. But this Salem Radio has, they're mainly Christian, the Fish and that kind of stuff around. And, but they have mainstream talkers. And we were on about 10 of their mainstream talkers around the nation. Now, Christian radio, you got to understand, is a unique kind of radio. The rest of it's different than other radio, again, because it's nonprofit. So people like James Dobson or the Bible Answer Man or Dennis Rainey, Family Life Today, if you're listening to any of those Christian radio shows, they pay the radio station money to be on their station. And then they gather donations from their listeners in order to pay. They buy the time. It's purchased time. No other version of radio does that, only Christian. And Salem's mainly in that business, so that's kind of how their minds work. But they had the traditional talker over here like we have, where we just split the clock with them and they, you know, they have to go sell their ads. So their CEO looks down one day and realizes we're on a whole bunch of their stations, and then he came to one of our big events, which we invited him to show him how successful his radio station was and how they could go sell a bunch of ads and make money. Only he didn't see it that way. What he saw was we were making a bunch of money off the as a result of being on his radio station. And so we've got like Atlanta and Louisville and Cleveland and Dallas and major cities with this guy. So he flies into Nashville on his private Lear to sit down with us to explain to us that we're going to start paying him several million dollars a year or he's going to take us off these stations. And we're like, well, you don't tell Laura Ingraham she has to do that. Yeah, but she's not making as much money off of this as you are. And I'm like, so the fact that I'm making money means I'm supposed to give some of it to you. You're really pissing me off here. So we had this conversation that didn't go real well. And he said, well, you need to decide, you know, that this is how it's going to be. And I said, well, okay, we'll talk about it around here and we'll figure out what we're going to do. And he gets on his Lear and leaves. And so we're like freaked out because this is, you know, 10 of our biggest stations. And we're getting ready to lose them all, or we got to pay millions of dollars a year starting today, ready, set, go. And, I mean, we're just freaking out. We're just, you know, fear. Yeah, fear would have been, that would have been the word, right? It was huge. And so we finally backed up and said, well, what we need are more options. This is how we operate. This is how we make decisions at our place. So it's not really something I want to do, but let's see what we could do about getting that station up there in Louisville. And what about those guys in Atlanta? You know, we hadn't talked to them in a while. And what about that guy over there in Dallas? Yeah, we might do that. So I got on a plane, flew to Atlanta, and landed a deal for Dallas, Kansas City, tied to my Nashville re-up on a contract with the same company, and signed a 3-year deal in advance that were actually better stations than we were currently on. We went on to another station in Louisville, Kentucky that was a little bit worse than the one we were on. We're still not back on in Cleveland. We lost that one. But we went way up, and we picked up Kansas City that we didn't even have. And so we called them back. It took us about 60 or 90 days to pull all that off, a lot of jet fuel, and we were flying around all over the place scrambling. And we basically replaced like 7 or 8 of the 10 markets that we were worried about. There were some little ones that we weren't worried about, but that were a big deal, and got them all set up. And then we called them back and said, you know, we're just not going to be able to do this. So you need to go ahead and give us our 90 days notice. And they went, what? Well, yeah, we're not paying you millions of dollars a year. And as a matter of fact, we're just going to leave your company completely. So you need to go ahead and give us 90 days notice. They're like, what? You're not going to pay us? No, we're not going to pay you. No one else pays you. We don't think this is right. We're not going to do it. We understand how you arrived at it. They're your radio stations. You get to do whatever with them you want, but we're not going to stay with you. Really? Wow. So they gave us notice out of the corporate office. Well, all the local guys that were making money on us reporting back to corporate office all went bananas. Huge backlash. Too late, though. We're gone. And so we ended up running an ad because then we were afraid they were going to drop PR in the trades that they had dumped us. And so we went ahead and did a preemptive strike with PR and just went into the ad, into the trades, and did a big article, Ramsey Leaves Salem, because they had asked us to pay and we don't pay to be on radio stations. It turned out to be one of the best moves that we've ever done. We ended up on bigger cities, bigger stations, picked up cities, and got a new level of respect from the industry that we had never done before. We would have never done it on our own. These guys pushing us into a spot of fear, us finding options, caused us to be in a place of blessing that we never would have gone to on our own. It was absolutely, they pushed us out of the nest and made us fly. It was, I mean, I am so thankful to them for trying to crap on us. You know? Really, honestly. It's huge. It's one of the best things that's happened in my whole radio career to us. And I'm not mad at Salem. I'm really not. And Ed Atzinger's the CEO. He's a friend. I like the guy. You know, he just has a different view on how the business works than the rest of the industry does, including me. And so, you know, we're not, maybe someday we'll be back on some of them, but we won't be paying. And so, you know, we didn't react in fear and go cow in the corner and go, well, there's only one thing we could do, and that's just pay them. It just sucks, but we just got to pay them. And we went, no, you know, what's the other possible thing we could do? We could just not be on any of them. What's that do? What sets us back about 3 years, maybe 4 years? We got to start again. And before I pay them, that's what I'm going to do. So we're going off of them. Now that we're going off of them, we've accepted our worst case scenario. Ouch, I can't breathe. So let's go get some of those other cities back by getting some other stations. And we jumped back into the market and we forced ourselves to go do that. That's what you do in a decision-making scenario where you've got the fear facing you. What do your guiding values tell you about this issue? How quickly can I make a decision in our organization if one of our team members decides to sleep with somebody that they are not married to? I will cry, and it will be sad, and it will be instantaneous. That's our guiding values. That's our organization. You may or may not choose to have something like that. But in our organization, that's part of our image. We hold ourselves out as people of faith, and so you can't act like a twerp and stay working for us. It doesn't work. And sometimes we've had that happen, sadly. And we had to have folk move on. And I still love them. A lot of them are still friends, but they can't be part of our team when they do that. My guiding value makes the decision instantly. How would other people, you know, I treat other people like I'd want to be treated. How do I make that decision? Well, I got to just think about how they'd want to be treated if I was in that situation. We had a company that, a video company that we did some, that we outsourced some editing to. And Louis Falsetti was over there doing some, looking over one of these editors' shoulders while we were building one of our products, editing a seminar video that we had done. And he met this young editor who's a rock star and got to talking to him. The guy had been through FPU and he goes, Louis, I've always wanted to work for y'all. Would you please let audio, you know, video editing be something y'all start doing and please hire me to do it. And so we're standing there at our vendor and their employee is wanting to come to work for us. I don't do that. Louis comes back and goes, this is a great guy, wants to come to work for us. I'm going, we don't steal team members from vendors. Why? Because if a vendor steals a team member from me, I'm not going to be a happy camper. I won't be using that vendor anymore. So what do we do? Well, I said, Louis, you know, the only thing you can do is you got to call the owner of the place with David's permission and ask permission to interview David. And so he did. And the guy says, well, yeah, you're welcome to interview him. That's fine. And if we took him away, would you be okay with that? Yeah, oh, I wouldn't be happy about it. He's a great guy. But if he wants to work over there, that's fine. And that's the proper way to do it with class. And we hired David and he still works for us. You know, absolutely fabulous. Contrast that to a little printing company that we were doing over $1.5 million worth of volume with, which is not a ton for us, but was a little bit of printing for us, and they stole two of my people. I look up and two of my people are working over there. I'm going, when did they call us and ask permission to interview our people? They didn't. Okay, well, then we don't do business with them anymore. Boom. They lost $1.5 million in volume instantaneously. And then later on, we bought a bunch of their inventory and stuff out when they went bankrupt. So, you know, and those two people that used to work for me don't have jobs now. And oh, darn, because we, by the way, we don't rehire.
My biggest focus on decision making when I'm talking with people is I believe fear is what either leads you or keeps you from making decisions. Fear has got to get out of the way. You have got to find a way to push that aside. And as Dave walked through, go through your worst case scenarios. What does it look like? What if you made the absolute worst decision? What would that look like? If you can't discover the decision through worst case scenarios, if you can't discover the decision through talking through friends, if you can't discover the decision through speaking to people who are experts, then write it all down. Get it all written down in a huge letter to yourself. Put every bit of information down on paper. And at that point, you should be able to go through and see all the little pieces that you say, okay, that's what I've got to do there. This is what I need to do. But until you even do that, sometimes it makes it very difficult to make a decision. For some of us, we can snap a decision in a heartbeat. Doesn't mean we make the right one. So for some of us, we need to slow down. But for those of you that you're struggling in this area, it makes it very difficult to make that decision. Do yourself a favor. Write it all down. Go back and read through it. Hopefully in there you can see the decision. So hopefully that's going to help you in your leadership as you make decisions. And if you're not a leader, hopefully that's still going to help you along your path because hopefully you want more than what you've got right now. So take that information, use it, change your life.
Hey, Chris.
Yo.
I used that lesson on my wife. She was having trouble trying to figure out whether she was more in love with Edward or more in love with Jacob, you know. And I've always said to her, I don't think any woman should have to make the decision between the love of a werewolf and the devotion of a vampire. But so I laid that out for her, and I said, just write out your, you know, what you think is the best case scenario and worst case scenario, and put it all together.
Yeah.
I know. The fact that I even had to have that conversation.
Did we just have that conversation on the Entree Leadership Podcast?
Please,
that
if you're listening, that did not happen.
Here's what I do know. Our great demographic of teenage girls are going to love that right now. They are absolutely... you know what? I'm going to decide to...
Wait. I haven't even gotten into the Hunger Games yet. So,
a lot of decisions to be made right there. I'm going to decide that we move on. What do you think?
All right.
One of my favorite people on the planet, an incredible, incredible author, hailed by a New York Times writer as a modern-day Will Rogers, who has quietly become one of the most influential people in America. How influential? Check this out. Andy here has spoken at the request of 4 different U.S. presidents. 4. Me? 0. Mefford, any U.S. president request for you to go speak?
Well, I was president of the tennis club back in my hometown, and
you got to speak there.
If I was picking speakers, I would have picked you.
Whoa! Get it? Are you serious?
Totally serious. Yeah.
Sweet. That's good to know, man. I like that. What does Dave say about Andy? This is no ordinary author. Andy Andrews is a life whisperer. He has a way of taking life's most confusing issues and simplifying them, allowing us to harness principles and reach our fullest potential. Folks, do me a huge favor and welcome the absolutely incredible Andy Andrews. Andy, it is so great to have you in here in the studio with us.
Oh, man, Chris, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
This is awesome. When I heard that you were coming to town, I couldn't wait to get you in the studio because you're one of my favorite authors. But more than anything, I don't know if people know this about you or you're not just an author. You're more than that. You're a storyteller.
Yeah, I do. I get labeled an author or a speaker, but people forget that the essence of both of those is a storyteller.
Absolutely.
And so that's really how I grew up. My favorite teachers in school were storytellers. My dad was a storyteller. So when I was learning something, I got told a story. When I was trying to be taught something, I was told a story. When I got in trouble, I was told a story. So I grew up with stories.
How did you realize how powerful a story can be? Or when did you realize how powerful? I mean, obviously, like you said, you got a lot of storytelling with correction and things as a kid, but when did you realize, oh my gosh, this really is powerful?
I was really more of a traditional stand-up comic. I was observational and that kind of thing. Mm. But when I started throwing in little anecdotes about growing up, and I started turning that material, because when I started, I was doing it really in a way like the only comedians I'd ever seen were on The Tonight Show. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing it like them. But when I started taking that material and turning it into a, let me tell you what happened when I was 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden the audience was responding to the same material in an entirely different way.
Wow.
And so I thought, wow, there is really something here. And so that's what I've really kept in my speaking career. And I work with a lot of different corporations, and I tell my wife, I said, it's not that I'm really any good. It's just that nobody does what I do.
I'm the only one doing it. So.
Yeah. Because any speaker tells jokes or they tell, but not very many speakers, can deliver serious material with humor.
Right.
And so that is where the story plays the part in there.
Well, I am going to disagree with you and say that I think you're absolutely fabulous
well,
at what you do.
You're very kind.
Is there, and one of the great things as a speaker is when you notice that moment when your crowd changes.
Right. And see, that's very cool for me to be sitting here talking to you because you know what you're talking about. Because you're working all over the country with corporations as a speaker and an awesome speaker and very effective. So it's neat to actually be talking to somebody who knows what they're talking about. I mean, no offense to everybody else.
Because nobody else knows what we're talking
about. Nobody knows. Well, I mean, this is speaker to speaker, you're asking a question from experience.
From being
on the
stage.
When an audience turns. You know that.
Well, I've learned a lot of that from you. Is there a secret or an art to telling a story? And for those of you that are listening, our business leaders and owners, I hope you're capturing why we're discussing this, that this is so vitally important for you as a team leader, leading people. So is there a secret or an art to telling a story?
Yeah, and the reason you tell a story when you really want to teach something is because people can can hear something and know it intellectually. Mm-hmm. But until they feel it emotionally, until they are moved emotionally, it rarely sticks with them. You know what I'm saying? I mean, how many times in your life when you were in school or when you had to study something for, you know, a business presentation, how many times did you wake up the next day and have that information just flowing through your head? But when you watched a movie that moved you emotionally, you woke up the next day and you were still feeling it.
Right.
I mean, and maybe it never left you and you talked about it for weeks. And so the same thing is true of a story. And so to tell people stories really connects with them emotionally, and to know what we're looking for and what your story needs more than anything is your authenticity. Mm. It needs your heart in it. Because over and over again, I see that whether you personally relate to their situation or they personally relate to yours, when you pour your heart into a story with your authenticity, even if they are not in that position, when you tear up, they tear up.
Oh,
when
yeah.
you smile, they smile. When you laugh, they brighten. And so this is not a theory. This is authentic. And so that's part of the thing I would really urge people to do when they are communicating, not speakers, but communicators, is to understand that your authentic experiences, your life story, is more compelling than anything you could possibly make up.
Sure. And if you're trying to lead somebody, if you're trying to guide somebody, mentor somebody, just telling them what to do, what not to do doesn't work as well. If they can get it, if they're teachable, that's a little bit different. But when you bring that personal side in, it's amazing.
Yeah, find a place in your life where, not necessarily where you experienced what that person is experiencing, mm-hmm. but find a place in your life where you felt what that person is feeling.
Right. Nice. I love that. You are a failure.
Yes, I certainly am.
You are a failure. What I love,
I know where you're going with this.
What I love, it's so difficult for people in leadership. It's so difficult for owners. It's so difficult for people who are bogged down every day to realize that failure is good. You know, fail as many times as you possibly can. Just don't fail at the same thing twice. You have failed. And as a matter of fact, the biggest failure that I know of, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, or don't correct me if it's something that we don't need to share, is the traveler's gift.
Right.
And when I say failure, this is a very successful book, but it didn't start out that way. Tell about that.
Right.
Tell what that's like for these people that are out there that are either afraid to fail or have failed many times. Tell about that situation.
First, you need to understand, and I'm not bragging when I say this, okay? I'm trying to give you some perspective. You know, this book is in almost 30 languages around the world. This book has sold a bajillion copies. Mm-hmm. You know, NFL teams use this. College teams use this. Corporations use this. People literally buy boxes of them and give them to their clients as gifts. I mean, this book, it seems, and it's still in hardback.
Right.
Right? It's still in hardback. And yet, here's the dirty little secret of the book. I couldn't get it published. And I'm not saying that I couldn't get it published, that 5 or 6 publishers or 10 or 12 publishers turned it down. What I'm saying is, for 3.5 years, 51 different publishers told me what I had written was not worth putting on paper. Mm. Now, you got to understand.
50, let me stop on that. 51 times you were rejected and said, this is not good.
Right. And these are by the experts in the industry, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I don't know anything about publishing books. I don't know anything really about selling books. And yet these experts said that what I had written, now you get rejection letters, but in essence, what they were saying, that what I had written was not worth putting on paper.
Man.
And so the curious thing, and I'm not being a smart aleck here, but not only that they were wrong, they were really wrong. Okay. And so it always amazes me at how many times we let other people determine the value of our worth and our work. Mm-hmm. And so here's something though, Chris, that time has given me about this. It's not that they were wrong and I was right and look how really wrong they continue to be to this very day. That's not the point. The point to me is that how many times in the past 8 or 9 years have I been able to use that story to lead somebody else to a success of their own? Because you would not believe how many people come up to me and they say, oh, you know, I'm trying to get a book published and I'm getting turned down over and over and over. And I'm like, really? Okay, now tell me exactly how many times. Well, three. Oh, three. Oh, yeah. Well, okay, that would be over and over and over. I get it. Okay, but when you listen to my story about the traveler's gift, does that encourage you a little bit? And they say, yes, you know, it really does. I say, okay, well, there you go. Because here is something that in my life, I would have never chosen it in a million years.
Right.
Okay. And yet the story, the struggle has value for you. Because I am absolutely certain that the greatest books ever written in the history of the world are in somebody's drawer.
Oh, sure.
Somewhere. Because they gave up after five or six or seven turndowns. And so this is very important to understand. That if you're a leader in your office, if you're an executive or leading a crew or whatever it is, you're leading five people or two people, never look at your own failures or your own shortcomings as a horrible thing.
Right.
It can actually define you as a leader. Because when you think about it, if you're leading people and trying to relate to people and trying to bring them to better heights, you have to get them through struggles of their own. And if they come to you and they say, man, this is what I'm experiencing, and it's just stopped me dead in my tracks. And if all you can say is, wow, that never happened to me. I got in here 30 years ago, never had a problem in 30 years. I mean, if that's all you can say, what value are you to that person?
Right.
But when that person's going through something, and you can say, you know what? I know exactly what you're talking about because I had the same thing happen, and let me tell you how I felt, and let me tell you what I did about it and how it ended up. So ultimately, I know you're in a horrible place, but ultimately, this is okay because I already traveled that road, and I know the ruts on it, and here's how we're going to get through it.
I think two aspects of that is, one, I think people are so afraid to fail because they've had such bad leadership. And when they fail, leadership is just, you know, hard, rips their head off. They treat them badly in that situation because leadership is the same person that they're, you know, the person that they're ripping their head off. They had the same bad leadership before them. So the person's afraid to fail. Leadership doesn't understand how good failure is.
Right.
You know, again, as long as they're not doing it over and over, the same thing over and over again. And so we have this bad situation where we can't come together on, okay, we've made a mistake, let's go forward. As long as it's not a fatal error, fail.
Right.
Do stuff. But if you're sitting out there today and you're struggling with your business, you're struggling with what's going on, you have to understand, don't quit.
Not only don't quit, but don't hide your failures.
Yeah. Well, I want to transition into something that has been, I don't even know how to put it, impactful for me lately. A couple of weeks ago, I picked up your book, How to Kill 11 People. 11 people. It's just 11. That's all it was.
wouldn't have been a very good book.
Not a very good book. 11 million people.
Right.
And I read through that thing and could not put it down. I mean, obviously, it was one of those, it's a fast read. It's not a novel.
Right. Literally take you 20 minutes to read the entire thing. And that just came out.
And man, I was blown away. So I want to go back and forth on this, but just tell me, how did this even come about?
Well, it is a good story about how it came about because I live in America just like you do, Chris, and you can't help but have noticed that this country seems to be getting meaner and meaner.
Absolutely.
And so it's gotten so crazy with one side yakking at another and the other side yakking at another side that there's a huge block of people right in the middle who have totally checked out. They're just not doing anything because they're so disgusted by the whole process. And so literally 5 years ago, I was praying in my office and this thought came to me. I really believe that the quality of our answers can only be determined by the quality of our questions. You want good answers in your life? You got to have good questions. And so this question came in my life. And I said, can I write something that only takes, you know, 15 or 20 minutes to read? So that would put it in the wheelhouse of anybody anywhere, even people who say they don't like to read. Can I write something that's very quick that never says Republican, never says Democrat, never says liberal, never says conservative, and yet every single person who reads it would agree with it?
Mm.
Now, obviously, I wasn't sure that even had an answer. What the heck could everybody agree on? And so there were a number of years that I kept fiddling with that question in my mind and in my prayers. And I'm also, now set that aside, I'm also very interested in odd history. You know, if you've read any of my books, you know that I have historical characters in them sometimes right. that everyday characters meet. And it's kind of a neat little passion of mine. But I read odd things, and I pull little threads and run down rabbit trails on the internet. And I actually read the Nuremberg trial transcripts, because I'm very interested in World War II. And something always bothered me about the Holocaust movies or books. Something bothered me beyond the obvious. And here's what it was. I would look at these movies or these documentaries, and you see very few armed soldiers loading thousands and thousands of people onto cattle cars to go to death camps. And I'm like, how do you do that? Right. I mean, I'm not what methods do you use or how crazy do you have to be.
It's not like they ran out of actors. It was being very
real. Right. How do you kill 11 million people? How do you get 11 million people to allow themselves to be killed? Because I'd watch that and I'd think, why don't they rush them?
Right.
Why don't they just fight? Why don't they run? Why don't they hide? There's no way they'll kill them all. There's thousands of them and very few. And so when I found out, because I dug for a couple of years, and when I found the answer, it stunned me. Because it was so obvious. It was so obvious and yet so hidden. I've never seen a documentary on it, never seen anything about it. Here's how you kill 11 million people. Very simple. You lie to them. And so these people loading themselves on the cattle cars, turns out they thought they were going to factory jobs. They thought they were going to new places. They thought they were being evacuated out of the way of the Russian front, which was advancing at that time. And they thought their children had schools all set in place because that's what they were told.
Right.
And so they loaded themselves onto the cattle cars. Well, obviously this is a technique still being used by some leaders to achieve various goals today.
Right.
Is this lying thing? And all of a sudden it clicked. What is it that everybody agrees on? And here's what it is. You walk outside today and you ask anybody, I don't care who they are, I don't care what income bracket they're from, what age, what color. You say, do you think it's okay for politicians to lie to us or should they tell the truth? Every single person you meet will say, oh, they should tell the truth.
Right.
And so turns out this is common ground. Now, do you mind me telling you a cool little story here?
No, absolutely.
There is a... There's an old story about a psychiatrist who had a client who thought he was a corpse. And every week this guy would come in and the psychiatrist was just crazy trying to figure out, how do I explain to this guy? How do I convince this guy he's not a corpse? But the guy wasn't having any of it. One day he came in and the psychiatrist had an idea and he asked the guy a question. He said, do corpses bleed? And the guy thought for a second. He said, no, we do not. All our bodily functions have ceased. And the psychiatrist took a needle out of his desk drawer, stuck the guy in the finger and squeezed it and showed it to him. And he said, what do you think about that? And the guy said, wow, corpses do bleed. Now, here's the point. Here's the point. It's a crazy little story, but here's the point. Anytime we directly confront what somebody absolutely believes, whether it's because their daddy told them 20 years ago or whether they saw it on TV last night. Anytime we directly confront what somebody believes, it's a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And we're likely to give them the opportunity to further entrench themselves in that belief.
Wow.
However, if we want to sell something, if we want to convince somebody, if we want to influence somebody, the only way we can do that is to find a little bitty thing that we agree on.
Mm-hmm.
See, the essence of influence is agreement.
Gosh, I love that. That is, that's fantastic. Let me just ask a couple of really quick questions. First, who are some of your favorite examples of past leaders, who guided their people with truth? Because this book is such a great example of how to lead people in the wrong direction by lying to them.
Right.
And doing it boldly and doing it loudly and doing it over and over again. Who are some of your examples of people who have done it with truth?
You know, one of the people who did it with truth is a character that I've used in a couple of my books, a guy named Joshua Chamberlain. He's in The Traveler's Gift. He's in The Final Summit. And Joshua Chamberlain was the guy at Gettysburg who charged with no ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, inspired his men to you know, go forward despite the crazy circumstance and everything. Well, if you look at his life, there's a biography called Soul of a Lion. And if you look at Chamberlain's life, you'll realize you can't help but read peripherally about him and know this guy had the hand of God on him. Mm. This guy was telling people the hard truth over and over again. He had the hand of God on him. But if you really start to investigate this life, not only did he have the hand of God on him, he knew it.
Yeah.
And he utilized that to great effect. Now, that's not only Chamberlain that has that opportunity.
Right.
That's you and me.
Right.
You know, George Washington Carver is another character in history that I believe knew he had the hand of God on him. And I would urge you, if you're listening to this, to make sure that you have that personal relationship with the Lord and that you have that Holy Spirit with you every moment because great decisions and great truth telling, you know, a great modern day example. And I know we're sitting in his studio right here, but I am one day. Now don't tell Dave this. Don't tell him this because Sharon might call me and say, don't do that. But I'm going to write a blog at some point, why Dave Ramsey is good for America, because this is a person. You can't help but watch or listen and know he tells the truth.
Right.
Sometimes, I mean, I've sat beside him and watched him do a show, and I've seen him cringe because I know he's thinking, I'm fixing to tell the truth here, and they're not going to like it, and I'd rather really make them feel good, but I got to tell them the truth because only the truth can change a life. And if only the truth can change a life, then the truth can change a nation.
Yeah.
And so we need people like Dave. We need people like George Washington Carver and Joshua Chamberlain who are willing to step up. And look, I don't mean to keep harping on this, but I feel like a lot of people don't talk because they don't know what to say. Again, and I don't want to keep harping on this, but this is why I created this cheap little book, How Do You Kill 11 Million People? To get people into a quick conversation with people they would never have a conversation with about something they actually agree on.
Right.
That, I mean, it is shocking to me. Chris, I tell people, you know, for years in my church, I didn't know who was Republicans or Democrats or liberals or conservatives. I didn't know. But now, of course, people come up to me and say, hey, I saw you on Fox News. Or they come up and say, hey, I saw you on MSNBC. But rarely does anybody say, hey, I watch you on MSNBC and Fox News. You know, so
right.
You kind of know where people are.
See, yeah.
And I have seen people who politically are totally different from me. And yet they're coming to me and go, this book, I'm using this book because, and see, now here is the little secret. Here's the little trick. The little trick is that, let me tell you a different story. I'll tell you a story to confirm this. All right. This is a cool story. I got called by a very, very powerful person. I don't need to say this person's name, but this is everybody knows this person. And they called at my house. And I was like, first, like, how'd you get this number?
It was me, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was you. But they called and they said, hey, I've just gotten a hold of this book, How Do You Kill 11 Million People? And I really love the book, but I saw you on MSNBC and I was a little bit disappointed with what you did with it. And I said,
wow.
Really? And I said, well, explain to me. And they said, well, Andy, you know, I've followed your career and I've read your books and I've even heard you speak, but you went on MSNBC and you didn't tell them. You didn't tell them that this is what they better understand, they better believe, and that they better believe this way. I said, you know what? Let me explain something to you. I said, we're in sales. We're all in sales. And he said, what? And I said, we're in sales. You got kids, you're in sales. You're married, you're in sales. You got a good marriage, you're just better in sales. Okay? And so we're in sales. I said, we have to sell our idea of the direction of this country. And we've watched people yell at each other for 200 years, and I'm not sure anybody has changed anybody's mind.
Right.
But here's the little trick. If we believe that what we know and what we believe is the truth, if we're convinced that we have the truth on our side, then we don't have to tell them what to believe. We just have to get them interested in a search for the truth, because when they find the truth, they'll be on our side anyway.
Gosh, I love that. Ah, that's fantastic. What can people do? Well, let me ask this first. Really quickly, with all these business leaders and owners out there right now,
right,
what have you learned, or what piece of advice is the most important thing that you could just quickly drop to them right now?
Live your life intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
That means seek wisdom intentionally. Connect with the people that you want to monitor their thoughts and their actions. You know, you need to be with Chris on Facebook. You need to be with Dave on Facebook and Twitter. You know, you can go on Facebook, Andy Andrews, click like. You'll be my friend. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to be with me on Facebook. I'd love for you to be on my andyandrews.com. But live your life intentionally. That means be intentional about what you read. You know, that means to be intentional with your time with your family, intentionally with your time with your children, intentional with your employees or employer, intentional with your life. So many people live their lives in an improvisational manner, and wow. it's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Coming from the comedian, in an improvisational manner. I love that. That's fantastic. How can people get more of you? How can they get, how do you kill 11 million people? How can they see what you're doing?
Yeah.
All that.
Well, 11 million people is in any bookstore right now. And I think Dave even carries them. We're, you know, 11millionpeople.com. I'm andyandrews.com. I'd love for you to put your address in there. And I write blogs that'll come to you free. I promise not to bug you. And Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Andy Andrews on Twitter, Andy Andrews on Facebook. And I'm having a great time. I think I'm in a great part of my life where I'm really learning a lot and trying to send that out to people as fast as I can.
Folks, I got to tell you, pick up any of these books and you will pick up all of Andy's books. You read one, you will want to read the rest. They're absolutely incredible. Andy, thank you so much for coming in.
Buddy, I'm honored you would take the time.
Really appreciate this. Andy Andrews, everybody. Gosh. Ah. What an interview. That, for me, that was fantastic. I hope you guys got the same out of that as I did. Leaders, what you've got to understand is there's a few great, the whole thing was fantastic, but couple of things in here. It's okay to fail. My gosh, you're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. Learn from those mistakes. Be like Andy is. Be a noticer of what's going on. See what's happening. Learn from those pieces. That part is okay. Just don't keep making the same mistakes. Be truthful. Be intentional with how you live your life. Be truthful. Be intentional on how you do your leadership. Lead your people in a way that they can look at you and be influenced. Because truthfully, as John Maxwell says, leadership and sales, leadership is influence. So, what a great interview. Mefford, what did you get out of that, man? That was phenomenal.
You know, there are a few things. The essence of influence is agreement.
Ugh.
So you can't, sometimes you go through life and say, you know, this guy and I, we disagree, but I can't really influence him. And if he's a team member or I'm leading him, if I can't find a place where I can pull him into agreement, I can't really influence him.
You know, it's funny. I was teaching, I was speaking in Mississippi at one of the universities, and I had person after person come up to me and say, listen, I've become a new leader in this position and I'm struggling with the people that I was on a peer level with. Because they don't want to accept me as a leader. And the truth is, it's because they're not coming to a place of that agreement. They're trying to get them to do things in a different way from a different leadership style now that they've stepped into that. And they're not getting anybody to agree with them. They're not influencing on it. So that's amazing. What else you got?
You know, the other thing, you and I spend a lot of time on the questions on our podcast because we don't want to get the standard stock. A lot of times we get guys in and they mail us questions and we kind of write our own. And it's interesting, you know, it says the quality of your answer is directly determined by the quality of your question. And we get a lot of people that tell us they really appreciate, you know, the questions. These are really unique. And I don't know whether they're being nice. I'd like to think that there was more to it than that. But, you know, we spend a lot of time on writing good questions. And if you want good answers, you got to spend the time asking the right questions.
That's it. Well, folks, we hope that you enjoyed this today. This was an absolutely fun podcast for us to do. The great Andy Andrews and his incredible stories. Make sure go out and get, I promise you, you buy one of his books, you'll buy the rest of them. So just go pick them all up. You might as well just do it now. Thank you for joining us again. Make sure that you're going to chrislicurto.com for daily leadership. It is free daily leadership where I am taking the information that we teach further in depth. If you want to learn more about Entree Leadership, go to entreleadership.com. Get more information there. Once again, I have to thank the incredible team that puts us together every single day. Chris Mefford, our incredible producer. Colin Fatkew, our audio extraordinaire. Becky Tennell.
Our traveler's gift.
Our traveler's gift. Nice. I love it. Obviously, Dave Ramsey and Andy Andrews for an incredible interview. Go out there, take this information, change your life, change your leadership, change your business. We look forward to talking to you on the next Entree Leadership Podcast.
Hey, this is Daniel Tardy with Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Master Series event. This event offers personal leadership coaching from our executive team, in addition to Dave teaching you his entire business playbook. We're thrilled to announce that our next event will be at the gorgeous Westin La Paloma Resort in Tucson, Arizona, May 6th through the 12th. Our last event sold out early. These events always sell out early because they're limited to 200 people. So if you want to lock in a seat, you better call our team today at 888-227-3223. Just ask for me, Daniel Tardy.
Folks, right now couldn't be a better time in history to operate or start a small business. If you're ready to take your leadership to the next level or start your own company, then join me, Dave Ramsey, for the one-day event based on my New York Times number one bestseller, Entree Leadership. At Entree Leadership One Day, I'll teach you everything you ever wanted to know about building and growing a business. Get your seats now at DaveRamsey.com or call 888-22-PEACE. That's 888-227-3223.
Running a business is not for wimps. If you lead people on a daily basis, you know how tough it is. You want your team to enjoy coming to work every day with the same level of passion you have. How can you do that? We've got three ways. John Acuff, Chris Hogan, and Chris Licurdo. These speakers travel the country inspiring business audiences, both large and small. They're not only endorsed by Dave Ramsey, they're on his team. They live and breathe Entree Leadership. They get it. And they know how to get it across to your people in their own unique styles. They'll share practical, proven, easy-to-understand principles that will impact how your team sees their work, and more importantly, how they see themselves. This is real-life stuff straight from the trenches. Dave's company has won Best Place to Work in Nashville 5 times in a row for a reason. You can win, too, but you have to be intentional about it. Call our speakers group to schedule John Acuff, Chris Hogan, or Chris Licurdo today. Call 888-284-2488. That's 888-284-2488 or online at DaveRamsey.com/speakers.